the discovery of psychedelics is the discovery that all of this cultural machinery is just Wizard of Oz stuff.
Don't think. Feel. It is like a finger pointing away to the moon. Don't concentrate on the finger or you will miss all that heavenly glory.
And they may well ask, why climb the highest mountain? Because that goal will serve to organize and measure the best of our energies and skills.
That's it. How did it feel to you?
We choose to go to the moon. We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other thing. Not because they are easy, but because they are hard.
The prophecy is true.
Welcome to the Astromind Podcast.
What's up, guys? It's Camo Kez. Thank you so much for joining me again on another episode of the Astromind Podcast. Here's peace, here's love, here's life. Take that. I hope you're having your best day. If you're not, choose to do so, because your reality rests in your mind. I want to give you guys that today. It's a good day. I'm feeling really good. I hope you guys are feeling really good. I've got an awesome guest on today. We're going to be wrapping it up very, very good here. Jeremy Norrie. He's a film producer, director. He's got 20 to 25 films out already. They're everywhere that you could find films. He's got experience with cannabis and fighting culture and fighting combat sports and things like that. So we're going to have a lot to talk about here. And I'm just excited to get into it. Jeremy, why don't you say hello to the audience and tell us a bit about yourself. What's this journey of yours? What inspired you to move through life and have these experiences?
No, my pleasure. Thank you for having me. Yeah, I am a producer and director of low-budget independent films, and I used to be in the cannabis industry. And I live in California, so it's kind of easy to understand how that could happen. Yeah. And I was in it for a long time. We did all kinds of different things. And nearing the kind of the last things that I was doing, those were concert and competitions that were traveling around all over the United States, internationally. And I knew that it was special. And so we started documenting those. I started having them filmed by a film crew. Mm-hmm. And that's the process that kind of began my real entry into filmmaking. I had dabbled in making some stuff when I was a kid. I made a movie about my first time going to the Cannabis Cup in Amsterdam. It was just like a home movie I made with two VCRs and a CD, a Discman. So kind of dating myself, how old I am. But nothing serious until this other movie. And when we started documenting the events, I thought it was going to be this like quick thing that was highlight videos to promote the events. And it kind of became this like bigger documentary, long-term thing that like took me so many years to kind of complete on my own. And then once we were done with it, with me and the filmmakers, that version, we couldn't get really placed anywhere. And I eventually met the people I work with now, who just, once I met them, they just opened all the doors that had been getting closed over and over and over, and just kind of held my hand and walked me through the whole process of doing all of this. And it's kind of interesting how there's like there's kind of a brotherhood, like a boys club to a certain degree, where you can't just jump into filmmaking super easy. You can kind of do that in some ways with like YouTube and things like that, but getting to the bigger platforms is really difficult. So that's my whole way that I did it. It was by meeting these other people, and they already had connections and just kind of showed me the way the world works. Mm.
And they just liked what you were doing, or did they see like, oh, wow, his stuff is really good. Let's take
it. Yeah, it was two things. So I am very outgoing. I've been through a lot, so not a lot scares me. I can kind of go up to whoever. I've been around famous people, you know, this is not going to be an issue for me to kind of approach getting interviews. Mm. And the person that I'm working with, he used to make horror movies. So it was a transition from making like narrative theatrical horror films to these independent documentaries. And he, personality-wise, has a lot of trouble with just going up to somebody and even just calling them cold call on the phone.
It's hard, man. It's not an easy thing to do. I worked in sales for a little while, and I did the cold call thing. People would come in, you'd have to pitch people, and to have that skill, you know, to be able to put yourself out there, it's not an easy thing. And oftentimes I find that people who are really good at it have had some sort of extreme experience when they were like in their developing years that they're just like, I don't care. Like I'm tougher than this. I can do this. These are just people. You know, what was that for you? What was that situation?
I've been through many situations. So I actually do have a book that is in the process of coming out. It's not out yet. But whenever I do all these podcasts or like things in the cannabis industry and stuff, I'm a really positive person. I try to talk about the positive experiences, but it never fails. The experiences people want to hear about once they get like a little taste of it are my bad experiences, because I've had some really interesting ones. Mm-hmm. So I've been home invaded a couple times. I've been almost arrested internationally. I've been arrested. Traveling state to state, like, so I have all these different stories, and depending on the different person, they want to hear about them. So
shoot, we may have to through everything. So it's interesting, what were you doing internationally to have the constables come after you?
So this is probably the most popular story that I tell. When I was doing my events in Spain. I've been to Amsterdam many times. I won the Cannabis Cup in Amsterdam, and I used to go just as a fan.
Mm. And what's the Cannabis Cup? I have no idea what this is. I'm a layman on all of this stuff. Sure.
So, kind of like the Oscars are the big event for movies. Sure. For cannabis, the big event is called the Cannabis Cup. Well, it was called the Cannabis Cup, and that was run by High Times Magazine. The time we live in right now, it's hard to say. Maybe could be the Emerald Cup. There's a few other events that exist right now that could maybe be the big event in cannabis. But at the time, for 20 years, maybe 30 years, it was High Times Magazine, and they were doing this event once a year in November in Amsterdam. And it was a competition basically between the coffee shops in Amsterdam. And they had other categories too. And so like sometimes people could smuggle cannabis in from other places and compete in this. Primarily it was a Dutch coffee shop competition. But it was prestigious, you know? So going over there and winning any of the categories in any sort of like, we won the product category for the very first dabbing tools. Mm-hmm. So that's prestigious. And in the cannabis world, you know, a lot of people don't know what it is. So even in Holland, you'd go around and I'd say, I'm in town for the Cannabis Cup. You'd be like, what's that?
Excuse me? Okay, that's cool. I mean, I've heard about dabs and all those. I'm not that much of a layman, but when it comes to like the more organized, you know, competitions and things, I just didn't know that was a thing. So do they like grade the marijuana that you guys are competing?
Yes. So you're talking to the perfect person, because I wrote the judging criteria for both of our events.
Okay.
So, and it's kind of self-explanatory, you know, right. It would be how you would judge food. It's like color, taste, smell, you know, your experience. Like these are kind of the way you would judge wine, the way you judge kind of anything that you're consuming.
I see.
And so, yeah, we would do that. And we were doing one in Spain. To get back to the criminal story. And I had been talked into taking one of the entries for one of the competitors that couldn't make it. So normally I would not be doing this sort of thing, but I've lived a risky life. He knew me well enough. He knew he could talk me into it. And so I put it in one of the, we had a whole bunch of prizes that people would win. And some of them were like, kind of elaborate machines. So I put it in the box with one of these kind of elaborate machines. And I threw it on my bag and I thought, this is going to be no big deal. I'd been to Amsterdam for the Cannabis Cup many times. Nobody ever talked to me going in and out of there. I figured this is going to be easy. I arrive in Spain, and I'm on the plane and I'm walking out of the plane and I notice the flight attendants are like talking to this like military looking guy. He looks like he's out of Desert Storm. He's got like a desert looking fatigues with like a little red beret and he has a machine gun. And so I'm like, okay, interesting. And they keep looking at me. And so I'm like, okay, this is kind of weird. I have my bag. I'm walking towards them. I'm waiting for them to talk to me. I'm looking at them. And the guy has my picture from my passport, like a photocopy or something.
Yeah.
And he shows it to me. And he says, hi. And he says my name. He says, you need to come with me. Don't worry. There's no problem. But you need to come with me. Get all your stuff. And let's go. And so I said, okay, I have everything. This is all my stuff. And the flight attendants are like, good riddance, you know? off we go. And I know something is wrong, even though he told me there's not.
Because you always know.
Yeah. So as we're walking through the airport, I say to him, like, can you tell me anything about what's going on here? He says, no, but don't worry. Everything is fine. And I kind of got this vibe, like, should I run right now? Like, maybe he can't. Like, why does he keep saying this to me? So we go downstairs to this, like, underground part of the airport. And there's a whole bunch of these military guys now. They're all over the place. And they have, there's, like, little sectioned off areas. And my stuff is all in this area where there's, like, a bunch of tables. And all my suitcases are on these tables open. But nobody had gone through them yet. And so he's like, oh, throw your other bag up on the table. We want to go through all your stuff. And I said, okay, no problem. And he's like, it's standard procedure. Like, he's still kind of giving me the, there's no big
deal.
Stay
calm. Right? No reason to react.
And I kind of know. I'm like, okay, one of my suitcases is literally filled with prizes for our event. So, like, this is odd. It's all kinds of metal stuff. And I know how the airports work in the United States. And if you have metal, anything, like anything large, they want to look at it,
yeah,
you know? And so that's what I figured. I'm like, huh, okay, they've seen all this stuff. They don't really know probably what's going on right now. Let's just play it cool. So I gave him permission. I said, yeah, go for it and look through my stuff. And I'm standing there watching and they're going through it, but they're not like the American police. They're like kind of going through it. They're almost being respectful. Like, not messing everything up.
They're being what?
Yeah, exactly. And so, like, there's this one bag that has all the stuff in it. And I see them starting to go through it. And they start saying to each other, Festival de Cannabis. And then the name of this city in Spain, like Castelldefels. I can't remember what the actual city was, but that's the city that we stayed in. So, you know. We'll
close enough.
Mm-hmm. And they keep saying it to each other. And I had timed our event at the same time they had a local event that was pretty big, that was for cannabis seeds. And so they thought I was here for that event. And they, you know, I gathered it. They're like saying the name Cannabis Festival de Cannabis and then the name of the city that that event is in. I'm like, okay. So none of them speak English either, except for like one of them. So one of them turns to me and he's like, hey, the guy that had come to get me, are you here for the Festival de Cannabis in this city? And I said, yes. And he said, oh, there's no problem. Do you have any paperwork to show that you have, because they're thinking I have a booth, like a vending booth there or something. And I'm like, no, I don't have that. And they're like, don't worry about it. Zip up the bags and out I go. Yeah, it felt like I robbed a bank.
Just made it out. Interesting.
Yeah, by the skin of my teeth.
Yeah. I've had run-ins with our police officers in the U.S. It's a very different situation. It's crazy, man. It's crazy what happens over here with
law enforcement. Yeah, I've had many.
Oh my gosh.
And in the airport here, what they do is they, so I've been caught with cannabis in the airport coming back from Amsterdam a couple of times. And they go through your bag like meticulously. It is unbelievable how like they're going through like my wallet. They're like going through every little like thing. Mm-hmm. They're going through each card, separating each credit card to see if there's anything. They're smart. Like here they know what they're doing, you know, and they are nasty about it. Like I've heard friends of mine have great experiences where it was no big deal. Not me. Like they found a pipe with residue and they're like, oh, this is cannabis. They tested it. They're like, whoa, they all start freaking out. They're like, okay. They gave me a little paper and it says, you have a fine of $500. Go window and pay it. And so I have to go to a window and pay it. One time they wouldn't even take like credit card. They were like cash only.
Oh, they want that money.
yeah. It's really a hustle. I never hear about it ever again. I've been busted with cannabis by the actual police. Hmm. They want to talk about it. There's like going to court. There's this whole, not in the airport. The airport, they just give you a little like a fine that you go immediately pay. It's just the biggest hustle.
And it was residue.
Yeah, exactly. So yeah.
Yeah, I've had this situation with police here, and it is a court thing. It's happened numerous times. You'd think I'd learn. I just so happened to be with a group of dudes. We had just graduated high school, I think. And you know, we were feeling tough, larger than life, that sort of thing. And they were like, yeah, you know, let's roll up here and there and let's drive around. And I was like, you know what, guys, let's probably not do that. That's probably not the best idea. You know, let's just stay in the house and do our thing. It was the day of graduation. We had just done the ceremonies earlier that day of practice. And so we were going to do it later on. They were like, yeah, let's smoke and whatever. And we'll go back and drink and all that. And, you know, as we're driving around, I keep reiterating, guys, we need to go inside. You know, I get that feeling like, should I get out of this car and leave them? Because they don't understand. And, you know, next thing you know, we turn a corner and then the lights and sirens, the cherries and berries are going. It's like, oh, no. And this police officer proceeds like it's like they know already somehow that something is going on in the car. Like we didn't run any lights. We didn't run any stop. None of that. We were driving just fine because we had stuff in the car. So he was like, yeah, you know, we're going to drive right at least. And so he comes up to the car and, you know, we've got like two joints or two blunts in rotation. One of the guys with the blunts, the driver, he takes one of them that's lit, shoves it in his mouth and just chews it up and swallows it whole.
Oh, boy.
it's such a crazy story. We had a girl with us, and at that time I it was a mess, and one of the guys was like, here, take the other blunt and hide it in crevices that won't be looked at. She was like, no, I'm not doing that. It's not happening. And so we pass it to the driver, and he proceeds to chew that one up and swallow that one as well. But as he does, he like coughs, and this like spray of weed is all over the dashboard and shit. And I'm like, oh no. And the officer comes up and like, what's going on here? You know, comes up to the window and he looks around a little bit and it smells like, you guys have been having some fun in here. Let me get you out of the car. And he proceeds to pat all of us down, each and every one of us. And he's like, you know what? We found this and this and that. We found some residue of this and some paraphernalia. We should take you guys to jail. And we're like, oh my God. Graduation day, like we have to leave from this to graduation. He's like, no, we're gonna be in jail for that. And and then we tell him, we plead the case, like, hey, we got graduation today, yada yada, this and that at this school. And he's like,
sure,
I'll give you a break. You're not gonna go to jail for this, but like you are gonna have fines and court and all this other stuff. And so it's a big mess, man. Like the fact that cannabis has moved away from being like, people can still go to jail for it. It's like, there are a few places still, I think like four or five states.
Here in California, you can easily just like not follow the legal laws and still end up in jail. It's relatively easy.
What are the legal laws? Is it like a certain amount?
I mean, you could even, so you have to transport the cannabis in your trunk.
Interesting.
So let's say you're driving around with an open container in your car in the front seat. You're still going to get in trouble. You know, it's legal, but it's like it's still something they want to be able to use in a lot of ways, yeah, right?
They make a lot of money from it. They can't just cannabis,
they can still be like, hey, what's going on in your car? You know, like it's all that kind of stuff still is like a thing.
It's a mess, man. And then there's the cannabis stocks and like all of these other things, and you know,
yeah,
that's an interesting world as well. Like I hear people making money off of that, and I've heard about it for years too. It's like, oh, you know, invest in cannabis stock, and I never know what to do with that. Is that something you've done?
So I have not done it. I know people that are doing it, mm-hmm. and it's a real thing. And you know, it's kind of like anything else. Theoretically, if these businesses are able to succeed in their business plans to become these like bigger, more socially involved companies, that they all have these like concepts, you know. Mm. If any of that stuff becomes real, then their value becomes real. And then just the one of the things in cannabis that you notice doing the competitions is hype drives this industry entirely. So whether you have the best cannabis in reality, or whether you are just the best at saying you have the best cannabis and all your, you know, business stuff looks real flashy and nice, it's going to work the same way for the stocks, you know, like you're appealing to the same exact people. Like if your thing looks really nice and sounds good and you're able to like get some hype, you can kind of pump it and get stuff going. And that's a real thing for a lot of stuff. So, you know, the cannabis stocks kind of just parallel that.
It seems like a lot of the Wolf of Wall Street, you know, I'm promoting some tech startup in a garage that's not actually going somewhere. You could just fake it. Like, I feel like we're living in the age of social media, fake it till you make it, and everybody's got on a mask sort of thing. You know?
Yeah, that has taken over the cannabis industry. As for us in California, as corporate money has come into it, it is very difficult to find like authentic craft cannabis. That's like, it used to be extremely prevalent in the medical scene. Now, just kind of the nature of how it all works, it's extremely difficult to find.
You say craft. What does that mean? Like craft beers? People are like making weird concoctions and.
So imagine like this, like when you're thinking about like how the best food is grown, you know, how is the best food grown? Is it grown in huge fields with massive, you know, agriculture and all of these huge farming equipment, massively plowed, you know, is that is it like smaller farms with like people kind of doing these things in a more hands-on way? And when you go to the market and you're looking for like that grass-fed beef or whatever it is, it's usually kind of a smaller company or you know, sometimes it's local companies. Cannabis is this way as well. And so as it's becoming big and they want to mass produce and and even transferring these small farmers into like these larger grows, there's a loss of quality that seems to be prevalent in a lot of these situations. So some people are able to kind of work around that, and it's starting to change. And I do have like long-term hope that in the future, this is going to be less of an issue. But right now, the big, big, massive grows are kind of putting a lot of the smaller farmers out of business and going back to the black market and like selling their stuff however they can. And I'd like to see that change. I'd like to see more of the craft cannabis and the smaller farmers get more of the forefront, and even just like less mass produced, like more localized cannabis for as you go place to place, the cannabis that's in those shops comes from the growers that live in those areas. That's what I'd like.
Yeah. See, that's the problem you get with big business and corporations coming in. Like, in order to make that money, you have to mass produce because they're trying to make as much money as possible. I mean, you can't fault them for that. That's how this society works, capitalism. You want to take a product and get it out there to as many people, but you do lose that, I want to say without being corny, the love in the product. We put a lot of love into our cannabis creation, you know, and there just isn't very much of that. Which is why I feel like we should be moving to a place where we can do things independently ourselves, as opposed to, you know, worrying or depending on these corporations to make things for us. Like you said, the grass-fed meat is going to be much better than the stuff that's processed, that, you know, they're slaughtering the animals in droves. And, you know, it's, I feel like it's different to live your life more connected to where you are and, you know, individualized doing your thing as opposed to this mass production. It feels soulless almost, you know, there's no art in it. And I feel like the way you're talking about cannabis and film specifically, there's an art to it. You know, there's a soul to it.
Yeah, absolutely. And our events were not just cannabis, but cannabis concentrate. So hash, right? Mm. And the name that became prevalent for people making hash was extract artist. And it's because, like, at a certain point, when you get to the finer end of things, a lot of things become art, you know? Like, we're talking about martial arts, boxing, they call it the sweet science, like, there's all this stuff, right? Yeah. So all this stuff that it becomes like this whole like really fine-tuned thing when it gets to the real top.
Like the upper echelons. Like when you really develop a skill at something, it's like then you can actually experience the mastery in it.
And it's like we're all at the same quality level, let's say, you know, and maybe it's not this is better than that in that sense, but it's different in a personal sense to like in more of an art way. Like who's to say this painting is more beautiful than this painting? But you can like a painting more than you like this other painting just because of how it speaks to you, and people's preference now starts to come into play. Yeah. So I like all of that.
Yeah, it's interesting. The nuances. I like that a lot. Yeah, we were talking about martial arts earlier. I've been on a big boxing kick lately, specifically because I injured my back in the gym last year sometime and it took me out of commission. And then I got COVID start of this year, health dieting went out the window. And, you know, here I am gaining extra poundage and I'm just like, this is not good. And so I start picking things up again. And one of the things is my love for combat sports, for martial arts. I've been doing martial arts since I've been doing some sort of martial arts. I think I started karate when I was maybe 8, somewhere young like that, maybe 9. And, you know, just involving myself with these different arts, because at this point, I love it. You know, it's beautiful to find the techniques and the movement and how the body works. And you do this in this situation. It's like chess, you know. It's like, you do this and you do that and you build up these strategies. How does someone like you go from film and cannabis cup to these more intense cage fighting UFC sort of things?
Yeah, it kind of all goes together. As a kid, I was way into like action movies and martial arts and stuff like that. I did taekwondo when I was a young tyke in the
young tyke.
7 to 10 age. So I loved it, but growing up where I grew up, it wasn't as big of a thing. And just in my family, we were a soccer family. And so I played soccer my whole life, pretty much. Hmm. But in high school, I saw the UFC for the first time. UFC 2 was the first one I ever saw. And I got it at this like illegal video store.
Like underground. Yeah. We can't be doing this.
It was literally in the like bad movie section. There was like murder movies
right like, next to the porn, like, yeah, you know, and
like films. Yeah. And then UFC was right there. And so I took to it right away. I loved wrestling growing up, like pro wrestling. Always loved all the different characters, and I got into it more and more in different ways. We never were able to like buy a lot of the pay-per-views, so it was like this thing kind of that like holding the carrot away from me for this long time. Like I wanted to be more into it than I was able to get, and I would get to see it here and there, but like it was this thing. And then there were all these weird kind of similar things coming out on pay-per-view on DirecTV. Some they look like real fighting, but then you would watch it and it's like
we're living the same life. DirecTV, yeah. And like I want to see some action. What's, you know, where's the fight?
As soon as you saw it, you're like, oh this is real shit.
Oh yeah,
no questions asked.
Oh yeah, this is real stuff.
And so from that point on, it became interesting to me. And as I got older, I eventually met a friend who, like, UFC went away. It, like, became banned from TV and stuff. And it had this, like, dark time where I wasn't following it anymore. And we got into, like, this hardcore wrestling stuff that was crazy. So it was, like, real enough that I was like, okay
this people are getting hurt.
and that's still really cool stuff. I still enjoy, but it's different. And I had a friend, and he's like, hey, I do jiu-jitsu. And I was like, what? And he's like, I trained to be a cage fighter. And he's like older than me, significantly older. And I was just so impressed by this. And then he started bringing videotapes over to my house again. It's like Pride videos.
Yeah.
And then as soon as I saw Pride, I was like, okay, it is on again.
It has happened, yes.
So I started like I sold weed out of my house. So we spent a lot of time watching different things on TV, and I would buy.
You just had time, and you were a businessman.
Oh yeah, it was good, you know. And so I would go to the Fry's electronics store, and I would look through their weird DVD section, and look what started to pop up in the weird DVD section: Pride DVDs. And so now I'm like, oh, okay, this is that thing from Japan. I know about this, and these are DVDs, and they're numbered. So now I can be like, okay, I'm gonna start watching all of these.
Yeah,
like,
just study.
It was still before I could like just YouTube all this stuff or whatever, you know, it was back then. So I started buying all the Pride DVDs and watching all the Pride DVDs. And then from him training, he's like, hey, you wanna come to jiu-jitsu class on Sundays? It's free. And
it's free?
Yeah, there's no teacher on Sunday. They just open the gym. And people are there.
Okay.
And so if you want to come in, there'll be people that'll want to roll with you if you want. And so I'm like, I know enough. Like, we would get in these little squabbles in my living room when I was selling weed. He especially, if nobody was there, he would attack me. He would just immediately attack me, and he would kind of play with me to where I would escape, and he would like work
it's
on
a transition and all this.
He always used to say, like, when he would get people, he'd be like, train with him with no muscle, try to only use technique with me. Because at first, like, you know, I couldn't really deal with a lot. Like, if somebody was going to muscle me around, like, they would just put me wherever. But if it was only technique, I stood a chance. So I started that way, and then eventually I started taking classes there. And then from there, I did other classes. I got confident that I was watching enough of it that I knew more than most of the at class. Nobody watched like I did for some reason. It was really bizarre.
It's strange. Yeah, it's like you really got to inundate yourself with this stuff. Yeah.
I started writing for some of the online websites that were like still focusing on it. And then UFC and all that started getting to be a bigger thing, and it got back on pay-per-view, and I just rode the whole wave of that all the way for a while. And I trained doing some boxing classes for a while. I did some mixed martial arts, like circuit training, and I did jiu-jitsu for a while, but I never belted up. And I was at the very first 10th Planet jiu-jitsu, so that is a famous place now. And Joe Rogan was like in my class.
Oh damn.
So yeah. So it was cool. And that's how I loved it all, and I still watch and keep up with it all, even though I don't really have a role in that world. We made a movie that is a martial arts based movie. And I do more of that, but you know.
And like you said, all the movies you have are on your website. What's the URL for that?
So my website is called theskyisland.com.
Okay.
And all my movies are on there, and links to somewhere where you could watch them for free is on each one. Some of them are available more places than others. As they are new, they are available in less places at first, but the older ones are available quite a lot of places.
Yeah. Did you ever have an opportunity to compete in the octagon, as they say, or, you know?
So, I competed in class once, and it did not go well. But I had that itch. Like, for a while, when I was training, everybody was competing. And so there's like this kind of thing in the back of your mind, like, I'm going to compete. Yeah. And so I remember at a certain point, I just was like, I have too much anxiety about competing. Like, this is not something I need to do. Yeah. I'm going to let this one go, and I'm not going to compete. My health problems and all, you know, it's not for me.
I feel that.
Yeah.
And that takes a bit of wisdom too. It's like, you know, I'm not going to do this.
Yeah. Yes, a different life. Like, had I got into that at a long, younger age, mm-hmm. and had a different youth, maybe I would have competed. But
yeah, I was much like that. Like, growing up, like I said, I started really young, like karate and things, and I loved the physicality and the techniques. And high school, when I got around to UFC, I feel like UFC was a bit bigger then when I got into it. I think there was one fight in particular that I remember that was just like, this is insane. Like, how this is happening. How is this on TV is what I thought. I think it was a Stefan Bonner versus Forrest Griffin.
Yeah. For the UFC, that is the fight that made their company.
That it was just a bloody mess. These two dudes, and they were going at it round after round, just like knocking each other. And I was like, oh my gosh, this is crazy. And that's what really caused me to like, I might want to do this one day. Like, I seeing this whole thing, you know, I was I think I want to do this. That's a crazy story.
At that point, the UFC was like $50 million in debt. And they had like done this TV show, like thinking this is how they were going to get popularity. And it kind of failed. Mm. And that fight like caused this like viral moment in the world of fighting. And all kinds of people watched it, and from that moment on, they went on to have success.
Yeah, it was, that's the one. After I saw that, I was like, yeah, this is it. I remember my friend coming over, and he was probably somewhere like 300 pounds then. I was probably about 170 on a good day, you know, soaking wet, 175. And I would have him come over, this is, you know, big dude, and I'd be like, we got to practice this. So I want to practice my moves on you. And I was like, if I practice with someone bigger, I have a better chance. And so, you know, I'd be like doing these flying arm bars on him, and he'd just kind of be holding me there. And I'd be like, yeah, it's the technique, though. I don't have to actually get you. It's just, you know, because you're too big. You know, we wouldn't be in the same weight class. But I remember like doing a lot of that, just like sparring and practice. And out of all my friends and the people I rolled with, everyone was always like, oh, yeah, if anybody was going to be in there, it'd be you. Just because you spent so much time watching it and doing it. You know, you're the only one of us that can actually fight. And I'd been in quite a few scraps then. I was a kid who got into a lot of fights for whatever reason. I was a nice kid, but you know, when you're the nice kid, you get picked on. So, you know, that sort of thing.
That's true.
But I do love the physicality, man. I love the technique and the flow. And like you said, it's art, you know, it's art, just like films.
It's primal. You know, I think my mom, I was watching some bare knuckle fighting the other day. So I love it all. And I kind of get into the smaller ones. Yeah. Right now, for me, one of the hot things is this BKFC, because it's a small thing, and it's like rising. It's the journey. You know, they always say the greatest part is the journey. So you can get in on the journey with BKFC right now and watch this get
that's,
to
that's
be
rough,
really cool.
Man.
But
that's rough.
My mom was watching it, and she's like, "Why would anyone do this?" Sort of. and I'm like, yeah, you know, like this is, I have to kind of explain this. This is a moment of like, look, you guys like soccer and everything, right? But like, it, a soccer game isn't going to break out at the club or like,
you're so silly.
Not going to happen. Like, yeah. It's not useful in life. This is basically a useless interest.
It's fun,
fighting, man, is primal. Fighting, it used to be that everyone, whether you were a woman or a man or whatever, you were going to fight in your life. Yeah. And it was very likely that if you weren't good enough at it, you were going to lose your life. And so this is deeply rooted in us for hundreds of thousands of years. Mm-hmm. Like, and I love the Dana White quote. He's like, there could be a soccer game on one corner of a field, and a baseball game on another, and a football game on another, and a basketball game on another. Let a fight break out.
And it's all over.
All of it is done. We're going to stop the games, and we're going to watch this fight.
Yeah, it's like a gladiator coliseum sort of thing. Like when a fight breaks out at like a school or something, that's the whole, you know, the whole cafeteria is in on this, the whole playground's in on this. And that was one of the best parts about these little scraps I'd get into, is that when they were going on, it was like procedure for everyone watching to form a circle around us and for us to like have at this thing, you know. Just thinking back to it, it's so silly. But it's like, it makes you feel good. It's like, I can defend myself. And it's this level of confidence that I feel like most people don't have if they haven't done a combat sport. If they've never been punched in the face, you'll live your life with this fear of being punched in the face.
Yep. Yep. You know? And that's, in our films, that was the moment for all these people. So, like, their stories essentially of... they're not really successful fighters. One guy is still fighting professionally, like he's still getting fights, but the other ones are kind of like past that point. But what they still train, they still do all this because the value that they got from fighting wasn't becoming a pro fighter. It was overcoming this adversity of like fear, of bullying, of like not being confident, like all of these things, depression, like it can help with so many things that you don't even realize. Learning a martial art or just like being confident in your physicality or ability to run or, you know, do things that are physical, defend yourself. All of that is a confidence that most people don't have, and they don't even know they're missing it.
Yeah.
So these girls, especially in the movies, really drove that home with how much it overcame the adversity in their life, and like it empowered them and changed their lives.
Yeah, and it definitely does. There's something about training the body and feeling that you're lethal. I tell this to my wife all the time. It's like, I just want to be lethal. Is that wrong? You know, I just want to know that if a situation were to break out, that I could, you know, I could defend us. And it's just like training, especially like growing up on action movies and like, you know, kung fu movies and things, like training was the best part to me, because I knew that if I was training twice, three times, four times as hard as the actual event that could happen, then I would handle it with like this grace and this finesse and like, you know, this Anderson Silva sort of like bob and weave and movement. It just, I'm at ease. I'm at peace. And I love that control over an otherwise stressful situation. It's the control for me that I like the most. So you never have control in life. You know?
Yeah. Humans love that. Like that's, as we're doing the psychedelic documentaries, that's one of the things that is, kind of indicative of people having a good or a bad experience is how their ability to lose control and be okay with that moment.
You could probably tell I don't do well with psychedelics. I don't feel like I've ever done well with it. I mean, I had one trip back when I was younger, and I was just smoking weed, but I had this crazy psychedelic experience. I was seeing things, everything was in slow motion, waving, colors changing in my eyes, and it just scared the hell out of me, because I wasn't expecting to go on this. Like, it lasted all day long. Like, not like a normal trip, it'd be like an hour and a half maybe. This was all day. I remember going to sleep like, I'll be like this forever, like, and it was just terrible. And since that point, it's been like cooking in a dented pot. Like every trip has had this connotation in mind. It's like PTSD. And so I take shrooms for the first time, and I'm like, all right, let's get ready for this. I wanted to take it for like the spirituality of it. You know, I wanted to go into it to like discover more of who I was and all of this. And it went largely good. Okay. I didn't take that much. Mm-hmm. You know, it went okay. It was like a half gram of dried whatever. Okay. It was muscariate or something. I don't know, cubensis. I don't remember what it was, it was like a half gram dried, and there was like a 60 to 90 second period where this intense terror was like beating down on me, And I was just like, oh my God, where's my music? You know, like the world is gonna disappear. And I started playing my music and I was like, oh, woosah, you know, trying to feel better. And it came to a certain point where it's like, you know, shrooms last forever. And I was like, all right, I'm ready to be done with this now, you know. So I can't imagine taking more intense stuff, like the DMT, the ayahuascas. And I know it's a thing of control.
So Marcus Aurelio has a really great quote about your life is essentially your thoughts, right? And so that is true also for your psychedelic experience. So if you go into these experiences with that thought, with that fear, it's extremely likely you're going to face that fear. And how are you going to deal with it? You know, are you going to be a victim of it? You're going to figure out a way to overcome it. A lot of people like that part about psychedelics is they figure out ways to deal with these problems that they don't like to face in other parts of their life, right? So they're going to do these psychedelics. They're going to face this problem and they're hopefully going to figure it out. You know, a lot of times that doesn't happen, but it's an ongoing thing. I've done all the ones you just mentioned. I've done DMT, salvia, acid, shrooms, ketamine. I've done
Man has got a rap sheet. Yeah, you were in it.
and I've had a lot of experiences where I can kind of like, some of them are shorter, you know, like doing DMT is a very short experience.
Right, I've heard it's like 15 minutes sort of
thing. Yeah, it can be very, and it can be where you don't like lose yourself. You're still very much there. You're aware of your personality the whole time. You're still there. Other drugs, you can lose yourself. Like, and salvia is one that I commonly refer to as like the scary sister of DMT.
Ooh.
And DMT and salvia are very similar that way. That like when it starts coming on, it comes on really fast and you lose your senses quickly, right? Mm. So as you start like, okay, I can't hold my body up anymore. That's like a scary moment for a lot of people. And you think about what that's like, but then when you actually can't do that, a lot of people go immediately into that thought that you had, like, okay, permanent injury. Like, yeah. I'll never recover from this. This is so far from the norm. So I'm so far away from like my homeostasis, my normal balanced part where I live my life and I operate this meat machine. Now the meat machine is like disconnected. And then when your personality goes away, that's a moment, even myself, I have trouble with that. It's letting go of that is extremely difficult. Some people are better at it than others, but I do think it is a very good thing for you. I've had a few moments where I've let go and I've had really blissful experiences, you know. And it's just you know, it's an illusion of life that we are in control. And so
that's a good one.
The more you can kind of accept that some things are just going to be out of our control and experience those things for what they are, I find those to be really wonderful journeys, especially like I don't like losing my personality. I'll do those things once in a while, and those are really profound experiences. But more or less, I like doing things like acid or shrooms that are these like kind of long journeys where it comes on, you feel it kind of coming on. For me, I used to get sick a lot of times. So it'd be this like thoughts, the negative thoughts for me is like, okay, now we're going to get sick. And then there's this period of like, okay, if I get past the feeling sick part, then I'm good. Then my mind is like, oh, we didn't get sick. Everything is all good now. And so that like that little process like puts me into a great place, and a lot of times I have these really wonderful experiences just doing normal stuff. And I describe it to people like, you're never gonna go look for the Temple of Doom, you know, you're not Indiana Jones. this whole adventure of life is probably never going to be part of your life. But when you do psychedelics, you can have those experiences. When you come out from the end of a like 6 or a 10 hour trip and you're like, I'm okay now.
I'm back.
You do feel like you accomplished some like tremendous like journey. Like, oh, wow, I went this whole, like, it was a big deal, you know? And I think those experiences are really, really good for humans. And that when you hear about how people lose their depression from doing these things, or like it helps people with being okay with death. All of those studies seem really believable after you've had some of those experiences.
Hmm. Yeah, not every experience has been bad that I've had. And a lot of the ones that I would call good have elements of bad in them. And my body is super sensitive, man, like super, super sensitive. I can smoke something, and if I'm really like, all right, let's really get into this, you know, it'll last a good while, and I'll be out of my body somewhere else doing all sort of stuff. But it's just scary as hell getting there because I don't have control. And that's the main thing for me. And I think it is good to kind of move away from this physical need for control. You know, that's why I got into spirituality. It seems like a psychedelic that takes a lot longer to hit, essentially. You know, you can have it all at once, as Joe Rogan says, or you can meditate for 10 years and then have this moment of bliss and, you know, this DMT escape sort of thing. And I've had some of those, and those are interesting. But there's something about the psychedelics where I feel like it's easier for most people to have that. You know, they call DMT the spirit molecule, you know, in that movie. It's easier for people to have that experience and say, oh, now it all makes sense. Like that fear of death that you're talking about.
Sure.
So I think that's interesting. Yeah.
Yeah, the moment of hallucinating is kind of not really understood by a lot of people. I've hallucinated a lot. Mm-hmm. So I've had hallucinations where I'm totally aware that I'm hallucinating. Like I'm watching some show on TV and I can tell, or usually it's like a music channel and there's like a fixed image that's now turning, or you're looking at some sort of like artwork and you can kind of see it's moving around you. And I had always heard of those things and not really thought they would be the way that are. It literally looks like these things are moving, and you in your mind are like, wow, it's happening. This is like what they say, and like you see in the movies where they're like making stuff kind of swirl around. That really happens in real life. But you can also have hallucinations that are indistinguishable from reality. In fact, some people say they feel more real than reality. And those are really powerful moments. I've done a lot of these strange phenomenon movies and talked to people that are like into all kinds of crazy things. And I think the power of the brain is just really underestimated. And what our brains are actually able to do is really underestimated. And so when you're having these psychedelic experiences, and like, let's say you're talking to a relative that passed away, that can be such a profound moment. Like you're convinced that they're in this other place still existing and that they're okay. And that gives you this like really wonderful reassurance. And I think that those moments for the people having them are really important. And I think that when you have a moment like that, it's profound. It seems, whether it is real or not, it seems so real that it lasts with you in your life.
Then it might as well be real.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. I've heard people say like, so I think this is another Joe Rogan. He's like, you know, whether or not you're actually going to another dimension on DMT, does it actually matter? You think you are and you're having this experience. So what makes that not real? And it kind of begs the question of what is our reality? And everything we experience of reality happens in our head. You know, we have our external stimuli, you know, our nervous system that picks up this information from the world. But how it's actually interpreted goes on in our brains, you know? And like you said, the power of the mind, there's so many crazy things. And that's why I love this spirituality thing. And I'm, you know, astral projection and all these other crazy phenomenons and things that people experience. is because it just kind of shines a light in a different direction. Like, hey, there's some cool stuff going over here. It's not all just physical and getting money and rat race. It's like, you know, there's some cool stuff over here. Maybe you should look into it. You know, I love
that. That's one of my main fascinations, is all of that kind of stuff. And I find that the distractions in life kind of take us away from those more important questions. And maybe we don't get answers, but those questions are just so fun to explore. And, you know, when I'm hiking in the forest, I don't want to be thinking about like a Ferrari or something. It's so far from my mind. I'm like looking at trees. I'm pondering life. I'm in a place that I get so much more value from than, chasing hot women. Or like I've lived a crazy life, you know, and I've pursued a lot of like things that when I was young, they were great, you know, and I'm happy I did all that stuff. But now being an older person, I see this tremendous value in kind of taking a step away from that and having a more simplified life, kind of getting more in touch with nature and the earth and other animals and just everything else that is part of what really makes me live and have a better life for myself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's more lasting. I feel like, you know, a lot of this stuff is just superficial, the fast car, and no one's ever going to be on their deathbed. Like, I wish I drove that thing a little more, you know, it's just these experiences I had, the people I loved and, you know, what I learned from life. That's why I like the Native Americans and how they live. It seems so much more connected, so much more in tune than what we have today. It's like it's laughable how much more fulfillment they get out of life than we do.
It's really odd. When we were doing the psychedelic documentary, mm-hmm. I interviewed a Native American tribe leader, and what's really, really tragic is they have a ton of sadness in this world, and they are like a lot of their people, they look at it in a strange way, right? Mm. They look at it as like a victimization from the Western culture on their traditional Native American culture, that they didn't want this whole have a job and like work lifestyle.
It doesn't feel natural.
It was about living off the land and like taking care of feeding and keeping this natural cycle. And like, I'll tell you another thing, they do this ritual where they take 20 grams of shrooms.
My God, you talk about Terrence McKenna's 5 dried grams heroic dose. Oh my God.
Yeah. And so they like, it's this whole ritual process, and it's like,
yeah, it's gotta be, you're gonna die.
Crazy. And they like sit in like a sweat lodge thing. It's a whole thing. And
just make it as impossible as you can. That's crazy.
Like, I imagine the journeys that they're having though mentally, you know. It's unfortunate that these things are not like articulated to us in a more efficient way. But I would imagine that these experiences are exceptionally profound, and learning from them is probably a huge value.
Probably the most profound thing anyone has experienced. They're probably communicating with all sorts of beings. You know, I hear that ayahuasca's, they figured that out because the plant taught it to them. What the hell? How does that? I mean, out of all the, you know, indigenous plant life in that area of the world, they found the two things that, when mixed in this time, creates this chemical reaction that affects the brain and gives you all this. The odds are just impossible.
So I like to get into the brain stuff. I've had a few hallucinations that like gave me a real downer outlook on life, but I also have like a real fascination with the alternative, like what else could be out there. And so some of the stuff that our brain does is so fascinating. I've had shared hallucinations, right?
Yeah, how does that work?
Me and my friend both hallucinated the same thing, and we have different brains. So like something happened where we were like, either both a victim of the same stimulus, and just because of we have the same machine, essentially, it like did the same thing. But we could also be connecting, like kind of like linking up in some sort of a way. And I think that's really a fascinating concept. And I also think, so I've had a lot of these hallucinations, and when you hear like, oh, the plant told you, like that seems it's ridiculous. Like,
oh yeah, whatever.
But I've also had, so I've had a friend, one time he was in a burning house. Okay. Like his house had caught fire where they were camping in this like makeshift cabin in the woods, and it had caught fire while they were out there from some mishap with the camping equipment, right?
Sure.
And he was in another room, and he told me this story. He's like, he heard his sister saying his name, like, wake up. Then he eventually, it happened over and over, and then eventually he woke up, and then he went outside, and like he was able to save, you know, it was in time, you know, nothing bad happened. And his sister was already out there, and he's like, I heard you calling my name, and she's like, I didn't call your name. And so what happened there? Well, his brain figured out, like, the only way I'm getting this guy up is to have this hallucination that his sister is calling his name. And it did that. And he hallucinated that and then got up, and he was able to save his life. And there was some sort of a weird, like, self-preservation thing that his brain did to keep him alive.
Yeah.
You know, like his senses perceived, oh, like, something's wrong here, you know.
Yeah,
like,
not the burning house around me, I can sleep, you know, through, like, that, but
figured this out. But to get this person up, we have to get this person up. What, oh, how do we get him up? He's not waking up to smelling the smoke or whatever else is happening. Boom, that happens. And I've heard of other similar things like that, where you know, our even just at night, like when you think about sleeping and you have a dream and you're like exploring a new place in your dream, your brain created the new place, and it's hiding parts of that from your own self.
Yeah.
So that when you're look like, oh, I'm opening this door, I don't know what's behind it, and then here it is. Like, this whole process is this bizarre circle that your brain is doing, like, theoretically every night with no stimulation of any drugs or anything. Like, our brains are incredible.
It makes you think, like, if that's possible, like you said, if it's possible for when you sleep, for your mind to keep secrets from you, then it's like, are we two separate things? And then it'd make you think, is that happening in my real life right now? That somehow information is being kept from me in this possible illusion that we're living in?
Another thing I love is mentalism. So if you've ever seen mentalism, where they're like, they're essentially just like cueing you with things that you don't perceive and making you have the answers that they want you to present. And so I watched a mentalist do this. Actually, Joe Rogan is the one he did it to. He was doing this show on TV called Joe Rogan Explains Everything.
Oh, I think, and, yeah, I saw a little bit of that.
He's my favorite mentalist. His name is Banachek. And he actually was he participated in this thing where they were convincing these MIT scientists that psychic stuff was real. They had them all baffled because they know these tricks. They're extremely good. And so he does this one to Joe where he's like, think of a shape, and then I'm going to tell you what shape you're thinking of. And then he tells him triangle, right? And then he goes, he's like, so here's how I did it. And like, there's a part where he's like, don't think of a shape like this. And he's like doing a square. And then he's like, think of a shape that does like something like
and
this.
He's like,
doing a triangle, right? And Joe Rogan says triangle because he's just doing this, like, essentially. Right.
Yeah.
And I say, like, this is kind of the they live concept of the world, or how much of the world is this Banachek doing a triangle? And we're like, triangle. How much of it is like these billboards, like, eat food and we're just eat food, you know?
We're hypnotized. In a way, that's that neuro-linguistic programming that Banachek probably knows, you know, saying something with a certain cadence. Like if I were to talk to you and start whispering, you know, we were in person, you'd move in closer like I had something to say. You know, all these little things that our minds pick up on, you press the little buttons like a computer. We're hypnotized. We're all hypnotized. What makes you think maybe these corporations, maybe these heads of states and governments are just Banachek-ing everyone into thinking that this is the way that life's supposed to work. Like the Native Americans, like, we weren't supposed to be doing all this 9-to-5 shit. We're supposed to be living off the land. Like, what happened?
Yeah, I agree with a lot of that. And the fear is also like, so are they doing that on purpose or are they just dumb and they don't even know what they're doing?
Oh,
and they're
no, just, dude. You
know, we're all doing all kinds of crazy stuff and who knows
you
where
you have to
going.
Know. I mean, if it's an accident, it only happens once in a while. Before it to happen consistently and, you know, marketing and the way that works and, you know, it's got to be on purpose. There's an agenda.
A lot of it, for sure. Yeah.
It's got to be an agenda.
Yeah.
So one of the things I saw about you was that you made some films on UFOs and Bigfoot and things like that. Mm-hmm. Now, that's a strange one. I love that stuff. I love talking about that. What have you found that's like, oh, I believe it. Do you believe it?
Yeah. A lot of it is downers, you know, where you think something and then as you start to talk to these people, like, you get kind of the bubble bursts in a lot of ways. But there are stories out there that I think are fascinating. There's a few stories from history. There's a film actually I really like called The Phenomenon, and they go over quite a number of the really good stories in there. And one of the stories they do that I really like is this story of these children where they're all like on the playground. Mm-hmm. You know, imagine a school full of children. So theoretically, I guess hundreds of kids on a playground. And this like UFO thing or whatever, like I forget if it appears or if it like flew down and landed, but it's close enough to them to where they get like feet away from it. Mm-hmm. And like all the kids like drew pictures of it. So there's like this amazing evidence. And then in the film, they go back and they revisit with the kids. And they're like, now you're adults, let's talk. And they're like, yep, this is, you know, they still tell the same stories. They still remember it in the same ways. It was still this profound thing to them. And like, it's really fascinating to see those things. The stories where they turn off like nuclear silos or they
I've heard some of that.
Military interactions. All of those are the best ones. So
really interesting. And then we've got like this we've got Navy like captains and things coming out talking about we've been chasing these UAPs, they're calling unidentified flying anomalies or something like that, and they're like we've been following these things around, they go from here to there instantly, and they've got like footage of it. And now if it's like, if we can't believe the people who are supposed to be protecting us, we have a big problem with our country.
Absolutely.
If they're saying it, it's got to be something.
When I interviewed Nick Pope, he's the Ministry of Defense, the UK Ministry of Defense UFO guy.
Oh, yeah.
And so I interviewed him, and then I had him off camera.
Oh.
And I said to him, I'm like, hey, what do you think these things
the
are?
The secrets?
Right? And he said he thought they were military. And he started explaining to me that Russia has hypersonic missiles that are kind of similar technology to how these things seem like they work in some ways. And that we don't have those. And he just was suspicious that these were Russian or Chinese military projects.
That's what they always say.
Yeah. So I was very disappointed. He wasn't on camera and everything. And like he's the most like reasonable person out of them all. When we were talking about the stuff on camera, he gave me a lot of really like kind of UFO and it could be real stuff.
Right.
But then his actual personal opinion seemed more like he was disappointed himself that as he's been looking into these things, it seems more like these could maybe be military projects. And so I don't know. I want them to be aliens, you know, and I just want the definitive proof. I hate all this, like, hiding it and, like, going back and forth and, like, I just want to get it out there, you know?
Yeah, me too, man. It's to just have the definitive answer, like, it means the end of the game. It's like, all right, well, we know now, we can move on with our lives. Because a lot of people they're just going to move on. They're just like, oh, yeah, whatever. Yeah, I can move on with life now. That's answered. But, like, what does it mean for us if there's a civilization or some entities that can traverse space-time easily and effortlessly? I mean, some of the things that that I would see on, like, Joe Rogan's podcast, you know, like, these Navy guys come up and talk about these things that they were chasing and that eluded them and moved all over the place. If it's Russia or China, then they would be so far ahead of us technologically.
Yeah.
That it would be over. They'd already rule the world. It'd be that sort of thing where it's like, it's a done deal.
That's part of what I've been saying is like, okay, so if they have these things and now Russia's in this war, this is when we're going to see it busted out, right? Like, this is, they got it. Like, maybe we're going to see it in action. Yeah. They've used the hypersonic missiles that they've been okay with letting us all know that they have. Mm-hmm. What else do we have? And what else do they have? Because we for sure don't know everything.
Well, you see Bob Lazar in this documentary, Bob Lazar, like UFOs flying. So he's talking about like this gravitational shit and how they move with like, gravity. And it's like, oh, I've never heard that before. You know, like the saucer does something like this and then moves like that because it's like moving gravity into this spot. And then you see like NASA is like, hey, we've got this thing where we kind of like fold reality in front of this ship to make it move. So it's not actually moving. We're just pulling things through. It's so weird.
Yeah.
Maybe we've got the technology, but where did we get it from? Is what Bob Lazar would say. Where did we find it?
I find all that fascinating.
I love that stuff, man. Because it's like you said, the you know, Temple of Doom is a sort of thing. It's like we're never actually gonna have that adventure. This stuff kind of makes it seem like we're in that adventure right now.
Yeah, and you can still go to some of these places and like go to the like little museums and what have you, and you can still kind of like live that like that thought that like what the truth is out there, you know.
There's so many crazy things, man. Yeah. So many crazy things with Egypt that I've seen, where these like portals and things like that people talk about. There's just so much weird stuff to where you'd think, if 1% of the weird stuff is real, then we're living in a very different world than we thought. Just 1%. Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. If any of it is real, it's crazy.
Just the quantum physics that people talk about when they're talking about like quantum entanglement and all these like things that are considered mainstream science. And they just sound like more bizarre than any science fiction that you've ever seen. And we're going to continue to learn new stuff. Mm-hmm. So, like,
I just want to be a part of it, man.
Yeah, it's going to be a wonderful ride. Yeah.
I'm trying to be there. Well, it's been a good one so far. I think we're going to close out on there. We could talk about this stuff all day, though, I feel like. Jeremy, it's been a pleasure having you on the show, man. We got to have you on again. Got to talk some more. Let people know where they can find your information and find your films and things like that another time.
Absolutely. TheSkyIsland.com is where all my films are. All my social medias are linked there. You can kind of read details about awards my movies have won and press. And you can get all the links to everything that you need about my movies or my IMDb page or any of that stuff from my website, theskyisland.com. And free links to watch my movies. So I encourage you to have a look through there. There's probably a couple you would enjoy if you like UFOs.
Oh, you already know, man.
Yeah, we've got a couple good ones. So check it out. And I'm happy to come back and talk about any of that stuff. Dude. Actually, I just did a new movie that's about a whole different topic. It's my first movie that came to us, and we were able to kind of make it happen for them. It's the first award show for African-American comedians. It was called the AHAs, the African-American Humor Awards. And it was 30 years ago they started it, and then they did an anniversary show just recently. And it was really an amazing experience. And their whole thing was that 30 years ago and plus, African-American comedians were really driving the whole comedy movement, and they really didn't get the recognition that they deserved. in all the award shows. I mean, it's, we had that same thing in the Oscars not all that long ago, right? So that whole concept was their purpose, and they brought it to other minorities too, where they would start recognize Asian comedians or Latino, and it was a really wonderful story. So I would love to come back and talk about that or any other of my films that you would like to watch.
Give me a chance to watch this the psychedelic one and this UFO Bigfoot sort of things, because I love that stuff. This is my day to do a ton of research anyway, so after this, you know, I'm gonna get on and kind of watch some things. It's been a blast, man. And when you finish your book, come on back on. We'll talk about that book. I love the way your mind works, man. We're kindred spirits. I feel like I've known you. You know, we're far too similar, dude. It's been a pleasure, man. Thank you so much. And that's going to do it for this episode of the Astromind Podcast, guys. Thank you so much for joining me again. The links to Jeremy's website is going to be in the description of this video and the show notes, so you guys can find them there. If you want to get in contact with him, it's going to be on the website. If you want to get in contact with me, it's going to be in the description. It's going to be in the show notes. You want to pick up the book, The Cure for Enlightenment, it's going to be there. You guys know I love you. I love the community, my Astromind Mystics. We're doing this thing all the time. Blessings, love and light, namaste, and as always, never stop adventuring. They've all but abandoned our small minds, scream about nothing but fear, trying to run up a decline. Maybe one day we'll learn the truth, maybe we're blind by design.